are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, October 14th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live-ish steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. Folks, it is Columbus Day or Indigenous Peoples Day. However you celebrate that. We are not in studio per se today. Although Matt may be playing this right now.
Yep, I'll be in here.
And instead, we have for you two great interviews. One is with Naomi Klein. She, of course, is the longtime economic justice activist, best-selling author, of course, of No Logo, of Disaster Capitalism. Writing about disaster capitalism, I should say. She has a most recent book, On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal. I sat down with the shock doctrine, not the disaster capitalism. The shock doctrine was about that. Sat down... or I should say I spoke to her on the phone a couple of days ago. I guess it was last Thursday. And we spoke for 40-some-odd minutes about the Green New Deal and about the changes in the climate movement. And to some extent, how the climate movement itself has in some ways achieved what it could achieve, and that the battle is actually sort of larger now. In part because it always had to be to some extent, but largely I think because we didn't have this conversation 30 years ago. Very interesting stuff. Before we get to that, on Friday, I spoke to Alif Sarakan. She is an activist with the Kurdish Women's Movement. And, she is in touch with people on the ground in northern Syria. I spoke to her for about 20 minutes to get an update as of Friday on what the situation was in northern Syria, what the asks were of the Kurdish people and the affiliated people in the in this autonomous region of northern Syria. And her perspective on why this was happening, et cetera. And of course, to some extent, we talked about the unique dynamic that is taking place there in terms of women's rights and their power within this region and their sort of administrative body. So we will play both those. First, we will hear from Alif Sarakan, and then a couple of ads, and then Naomi Klein. We will be back live tomorrow. We will also tomorrow be covering the Democratic debate at night. And also, if you want to get a little bit of news from today, check out the AM Quickie. You can sign up for it at amquickie.com. It is 5 minutes of headlines and brief, like little news stories that will give you a sense of what's going on. We try and give you some of the stuff as the mainstream news is reporting, but also stuff that maybe you would miss by listening to mainstream news. So check it out. AM Quickie. We do it every morning. It's usually put out by 8:30 in the morning, sometimes a little earlier. So subscribe to that right now. Big help to us. You can do it through Spotify. You can do it through Stitcher. You can do it through iTunes. You can do it on your Android. Just go, or you can do it on your computer, I guess. Go to amquickie.com to subscribe if you're not going to go right through those systems. Here is a first interview with Elif Sarakhan. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Pleasure to welcome to the program Elif Sarakhan. She is a Kurdish women's movement activist. Elif, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, I mean, will you please, explain for us, just before we get to the situation that is on the ground in northern Syria, explain to us, just give us some of the basic facts in terms of the Kurdish population there. The area is it all considered Rojava? Just, I mean, explain this just for us to give us just a little bit of a sense of the sort of the material situation.
Sure. So Rojava literally means west in Kurdish, and it's kind of like historically referred to the western region of, you know, like the mass, the land that the Kurdish people inhabit. And, the situation that unfolded, especially since 2012, with the declaration of the Rojava Revolution, which has now, because it has evolved into a much larger coalition, including Arabs, many Christian groups like Syriacs, Assyrians, Armenians, and Turkmens and Yazidis, and so on. It's evolved into something called the Autonomous Administration of Northeast Syria. And so right now, the administration encompasses a population of 5 million people, in which about just under 3 million are Kurds. And so these people, while fighting ISIS over the last years, and having sacrificed 11,000 fighters in this battle, have also been implementing a very inspiring system based on the principles of direct democracy, ecology, and women's liberation. And the women's liberation aspect is incredibly important and very central to all of this, because every level of society and administration is organized around women's liberation, and therefore there must, you know, there's a few rules to make sure that, you know, essentially there's an institutionalization of women's liberation, including a 40% quota for women at every level of society and administration, and also a co-chair system where, again, every level of society and administration, from the commune level up to the canton and confederation level, has a man and a woman as a co-chair. And you know, this isn't just the civil aspect of it, but also, as many people may have seen or heard, women were at the forefront of fighting against ISIS as well, and in achieving the defeat of ISIS, particularly in liberating the de facto capital of the caliphate in Raqqa in 2017. Right. Women spearheaded this liberation, and the declaration, the main declaration, was also made by women fighters.
We've talked a little bit on this program over the years about this really, in many ways, an experiment that's going on in Rojava. Let's just for a moment, before we return to that, I want to just talk about sort of the more of the specific situation that we have on the ground. So this has been a region that since the beginning of the civil war, and I mean presumably prior to this, but since the beginning of the civil war in Syria, has been largely fighting ISIS. How many fighters are representing that? And I'm sorry, the name of the region now, not Rojava, but you had said
it's the Autonomous Administration of Northeast Syria.
Okay, and so how many fighters were engaged in the fight against ISIS over the past several years?
I mean, it's difficult to say exactly how many fighters were engaged in the fight. We know that 11,000 fighters were killed in the fight against ISIS, you know, who were obviously a lot of, there were many Kurds in this that are a part of this figure. There's many Arabs and other groups as well, Yazidis, who were incredibly important and spearheaded the liberation of Raqqa. And also there's 22,000 wounded who in the fight against ISIS.
Now, my
including tens of internationalist fighters, many from the US. There's 8 international fighters who sacrificed their lives from Britain and many from many other international countries, including Spain, Italy, Germany, and many other places.
Okay. And so at what point was there, my understanding is that there was an agreement at one point, I don't know if it was actually formalized, but certainly it was implemented. At what point was the agreement between the autonomous administrative northern Syria and the U.S. and I guess presumably Turkey that created that 5-mile sort of space, safe zone, as it were, that can you give us the background on that situation?
The question and discussion and negotiations around the safe zone have been going on for a while now, and there was a back and forth. There was indirect negotiations between the SDF and the Turkish authorities, particularly through the US. And so, you know, there was a discussion around whether it would be 5 kilometers, 10, 15, and so on. And then there was a settlement, especially the Syrian Democratic Forces assumed there was a settlement at 5 kilometers, and that there would be some joint patrols with the US and Turkey and at some points within this 5 kilometers. And the Syrian Democratic Forces implemented their end of the bargain. They were asked to destroy some of their fortifications on the border, which they did. And then all of a sudden, as the whole world has been speaking about, you know, in this past week,
right,
Sunday night and Monday morning, UK time, but I think it was also Sunday night for the US, Trump announced that he was withdrawing from Syria, which came as a shock to many people, including his own army. I think, as far as we know, and according to what they have said, people on the army personnel on the ground, they got a call at like 3 a.m. saying, yeah, we've just got to leave. So they had no clue from before as well.
And we should be clear, there have been no U.S. troops withdrawn from Syria. They have just simply withdrawn from that region and have moved to a different area, is my understanding. So this is not a case of U.S. troops coming home. It is simply basically allowing the exposure of these folks that, have served in many respects as proxy fighters for the U.S. in fighting ISIS. Obviously, they have their own, incentive and reasons to fight as well. When were these fortifications that were on the border with Turkey, when were they basically pulled apart?
I mean, just to give it some context about, about the border situation as well, you know, The U.S. soldiers that were on the border, this was accepted by all sides, were essentially then, there weren't many of them. I think some figures say 50, some figures say 100, but I definitely haven't seen figures over 100. There were, some hundreds soldiers there stationed literally to act as human shields to prevent a Turkish invasion. And the soldiers themselves were very much aware of this. And, you know, the history of the fight against ISIS, it's important to understand that the fight against ISIS didn't start with the US. The Kurdish forces, the YPG and the YPJ, were already fighting against ISIS. When Kobani was under siege, the Kurdish forces were already fighting against it. The US was the one who then came after and said, we would like to assist you with air support. And this, according to Brett McGurk, who was the presidential envoy to Syria, who spent a lot of time on the ground, he said this decision didn't come because there were any other realistic alternatives, because they tried to speak and have discussions with the Turkish forces and Turkish authorities to see if they could fight against ISIS with the Turks. But he says, Brett McGurk, that they knew very, very early on and immediately that the Turkish-backed opposition in Syria was riddled with extremists, including Syria's al-Qaeda remnants, al-Nusra, but also some ISIS remnants as well. So it just wasn't a realistic option. And it's important to understand, because I think when the discussion is kind of framed in like a proxy way, it kind of takes the agency away from the Kurdish forces who right. were already engaged in this fight. They were already fighting. And Salih Muslim, who was the former co-president of the PYD, which is one of the main political parties, Kurdish political parties in Syria, he said, you know, we never invited the US and we're not going to ask them to stay. So this situation is actually less about the US, but more about a Turkish invasion. And therefore, it was just the US soldiers who happened to be acting as human shields. But everyone knew, the Syrian Democratic Forces knew, that this was a strategy that was always bound to expire, and therefore have been pushing for many years from the beginning of the fight against ISIS, but even before that, because the Kurdish forces had to fight against al-Nusra before ISIS came about as well, and had to fight against other extremist groups, had to have certain clashes with the Assad regime, even though, you know, the withdrawal from the north of Syria was relatively smooth, because Assad felt like he needed his power and his force more in the south of Syria. So he kind of, you know, withdrew from the north relatively smoothly, but there were still clashes and periodic clashes even until recently. They've kind of like calmed down because, you know, of obviously other interests at right. the moment, especially of the Assad regime. But that's really important to understand. And so about the fortifications, they were destroyed literally a few weeks ago to a month, you know, over the summer, basically. And a few weeks after the fortifications were destroyed, this is what Trump announced after a phone call with President Erdogan.
And I appreciate the point you're trying to make in terms of proxy. I guess, you know, to a certain extent, there were aligned agendas here. And the bulk of the fighting, like you say, has been done by the Kurdish forces and the broader forces of the autonomous northern Syria. And the point being that these are not losses that the United States have had to suffer. And it appears, at least from my perspective, and I'm curious as from yours, that it is obviously the Turks who are invading. And I want to talk just a little bit more about that in a moment. But it does appear to do it. Appear to me that they're doing it with it's completely sanctioned by the United States. That it, had the United States said no, had Donald Trump not said, you know, had said we're not taking those small handful of troops there, that this would not be happening.
Yeah. So it's unclear exactly what the conversation was between Erdogan and Trump on Sunday. But somehow Erdogan has been trying to convince Trump for many, many months, if not obviously a few years, to withdraw from that part of Syria, somehow found some leverage to be able to convince Trump. Right. Now, some say, and I think, you know, this is obviously speculation, some say that Erdogan has somehow promised Trump that he will give him some information on Biden. But again, no one knows exactly what the conversation was. Some of his own staff said that Trump was quite weak in this conversation and unfolded quite quickly. But, you know, Erdogan's been trying for a very long time. And finally, he got what he's been wishing for for many years, even before there was this tactical alliance between the Syrian Democratic Forces and the U.S. Because even during the resistance of Kobani, you know, the U.S. air support came in, you know, slightly into this battle. It wasn't there from the beginning. Erdogan would make statements every day on publicly on Turkish media saying Kobani is about to fall, and essentially welcoming an ISIS right. invasion of Kobani. And obviously we saw what happened in January 2018 in Afrin when he invaded again with his allied ground jihadi forces. In 2 months, about 1,000 people were killed. 300,000 out of an 800,000 population was displaced. And there was wide reports and, you know, reported by many, many different groups and media outlets of looting and looting by his, particularly his jihadi allies on the ground, but also of reacting or reenacting ISIS war weapons of sexual slavery and harassment against women.
My understanding is that the Kurdish forces are holding about 10,000, 11,000 ISIS prisoners, and then perhaps a multiple of that of or at least are in the area of families of the ISIS fighters. I don't know if that figure is true or not. You might have a better sense of that. Can you tell me what you know about those prisoners and how are they going to be, what's going to happen to them in this context?
So the figures you say are pretty accurate. And so, this figure is across several prisons across, again, the region that is under Syrian Democratic Forces control. But
these must be big. When we talk about prisons, these must be big, like what look like refugee camps, right? I would imagine, right? I mean, they don't have cells for 12,000 people. These are like big camps. Is that not right?
So some of mainly the families, the ISIS families, are in camps. The prisoners mainly that are in the ISIS fighters are in, more prison-like structures.
Okay.
But there's already been riots in some of the camps, particularly in Al-Hol camp. We saw videos of that today of people burning tents and beginning to riot. There was one of the prisons that is in Kamishlo, which is, again, one of the border towns, which is in the very northeast of Syria. There's, again, been riots in that prison. There's been some escapes from that prison as well. No one knows exactly what figure it is because it's just an incredibly chaotic situation because these people now, the Syrian Democratic Forces, have to obviously resist and fend off a Turkish invasion, but also still continue to try and keep these ISIS prisoners, imprisoned because they're obviously a threat to the whole of Syria, not just northeast Syria, and potentially the world.
And so what has happened in terms of on the ground of as far as bombings? I mean, how much of an incursion have where are the Turkish forces? What have they what have casualties been like at this point? And what are people anticipating in the region? I assume you're talking to folks on the ground.
Yeah. So at the moment, so on Wednesday, when they began the actual invasion, there was they began with six coordinated attacks across the border. They've been trying to take as many villages as they can, particularly on the border. And the civilian casualties, what we heard yesterday, again, it's difficult to get exact figures, especially in a chaotic situation like that. But it's in the tens. You know, yesterday the figure we had was over 10 civilians killed and about 20 injured. But today has been a very fierce day of fierce clashes. And so we know that the figure is much, much higher right now, but we just don't know exactly what. It's definitely in the tens, if not hundreds at this point. But it's even more scary that you can't get exact figures because the situation is escalating every single moment.
And so what is the ask here? Folks in this region could have, had the ability to wave their wand, what would that look like in terms of, I mean, obviously it would be the cessation of the invasion by Turkey, but by what means are people hoping that will happen?
So, just to summarize and put it, put the demands in context, it's this Turkish invasion, an illegal Turkish invasion, because an unprovoked attack is a war crime. And Erdogan declared this beforehand, that he was intending to commit ethnic cleansing when he was at the General Assembly of the United Nations just a few weeks ago. So he's not even making no secret of what he intends to do. And what it will do is four main things, which is cause the resurgence of ISIS. We've already seen that. It will it will essentially be a Kurdish genocide, and it will contribute to the international refugee crisis. There's already been 70,000 people displaced literally in a few days. And it's important to mention, because when people speak about the refugee crisis, they often speak about it as if it's a burden for you know, Europe and the US. But these people don't want to leave their homes. They leave right. because they have to. And so this is just going to add to their pain of trying to find somewhere that they can be safe. But also, and perhaps equally as importantly, it will crush the democratic, ecological, and women's liberationist system that that has been built there over the years. And this is one of the things that Erdogan sees as one of the biggest threats, because it's not just about Kurdish gains, but it's about what kind of Kurdish gains. And he sees that as a deep threat to his own power and his own authority, particularly domestically, but also across the region as well. And so the ask is, obviously, as you said, to reverse and stop this Turkish invasion. But one of the things that will that would make it a lot more difficult for the Turkish state to be able to carry out what they intend to carry out is for there to be a no-fly zone. So if they can't use air force, then they are considerably, you know, their power and their strength considerably decreases, of course. But also, you know, there's been a quite a good and effective sanctions bill that has been put together by, you know, by a bipartisan sanctions bill in the US, for obviously that to be passed and implemented and enforced, but also for other countries like Britain, like, you know, in the UK, but also other NATO countries to also carry out sanctions, you know, impose sanctions on Turkey until they stop this invasion. I saw that two days ago, Finland already stopped their arms sales with Turkey. I saw this morning Norway did that, and Holland has also suspended their arms sales to Turkey. And this is what we also need. We need internationally for the arms sales stop, but also on the ground for people who want to express solidarity. It's really important to follow the work Rise Up for Rojava is doing. And even on an individual level, to boycott Turkey culturally, academically, and touristically. No one should be holidaying in Turkey ever until they basically stop massacring Kurdish people. Because a lot of the companies that own and produce their arms are also the very same companies that own the major holiday resorts in the south of Turkey that a lot of people like to holiday in cheaply. But this any penny or pound you spend on holiday in Turkey literally directly translates into ammunition against the Kurdish people.
Alif Sarakhan, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Hey, folks, Babbel will get you speaking a new language quickly and with confidence. You can choose from 14 different languages: Spanish, French, Italian. What else did they have at Babbel? Russian, Portuguese, tons of languages. And the teaching method and speech recognition technology has been proven effective across multiple studies. Babbel's lessons are lovingly created by over 100 language experts. In other words, they're created by real people. These are not algorithms. Lessons are engaging and convenient. They last only 10 to 15 minutes. You can learn through interactive dialogues. So you'll perfect your pronunciation. You'll perfect your accent. Babbel is available as an app. It's available directly online. Babbel will sync your progress across all of the platforms. So you can go from the computer to your iPhone, to your iPad, to your tablet, whatever it is. You'll get synced all across the entire platforms. And we've got just about everybody in the office is now gearing up maybe for a major competition. I'm going to learn Spanish. To me, it just seems like the most obvious choice. But I can understand if people want to learn Russian or Portuguese or French or Italian. My sister speaks Italian. Trying to get Myla to use Babbel so that she can excel in it at school. If you haven't used Babbel, folks, you got to try this out now. And because you listen to the show, Babbel has a special offer for you. Go to Babbel.com, select the language of your choice. Once you try for free, you get a sense of it, you're ready to sign up, you select the 3-month option, and Babbel will give you 3 additional months for free. with the promo code Majority. That's 6 months for the cost of three with promo code Majority. Go to Babbel, B-A-B-B-E-L, B-A-B-B-E-L.com and enter promo code Majority. Babbel, speak a new language with confidence. And folks, recently, over 100 million people have had their personal information stolen in a major data breach. I'm not even going to tell you what happened to me on the subway the other day. But, you know, you don't always know when you're connected to folks, whether it's by Bluetooth or by whatever it is. You got to be careful. Social security numbers, contact details, credit scores, and more, all taken from Capital One customers. These kind of attacks are getting more and more frequent. They're getting more and more severe. And it's not just Capital One. Equifax, Facebook, eBay, Uber, PlayStation, Yahoo, they all have leaked passwords, all have leaked credit cards, all have leaked bank numbers belonging to billions of users. That's why you need ExpressVPN. Look, you can't control how big corporations mishandle your data, but you can protect yourself. ExpressVPN is an app for your computer, and it's an app for your phone that encrypts and secures your data. If you care about your privacy, if you care about your safety, you shouldn't go online at all without ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN connects with just one click. It's lightning fast, and the cost less than $7 a month. That is nothing for your peace of mind that your information won't be stolen, your accounts won't be hijacked. ExpressVPN is rated the number one VPN provider by TechRadar, CNET, The Verge, and countless others. Go to expressvpn.com/majority right now to arm yourself with an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. Support the show and protect yourself. That's expressvpn.com/majority for an extra 3 months free. Hey, what makes a better toothbrush? Is it industrial strength power, multiple modes? If you ask your dentist, they'll tell you it's less about the brush and more about how you use it. And this is what I've been on. I'm not a professional dentist, folks. I'm not even an amateur dentist. But I have done extensive reading on dental hygiene because I got completely into it a couple years ago. The bottom line is you need a toothbrush that fits your mouth, that you use on a regular basis. And Quip has sensitive vibrations, has a built-in timer. They guide the gentle brushing for the dentist recommended 2 minutes. 30-second pulses ensure an even clean. And Quip automatically delivers brush heads to you every 3 months for a clean new bristles right on schedule. That's what you're supposed to do. Change your toothbrush every 3 months, but you forget to do it. You can't remember. This is perfect for that because you don't have to. The sleek, intuitive design is simple to use. It comes with a travel cap that doubles as a mirror mount, too. Let's put it this way. Quip makes brushing something you actually want to do twice a day. And the bottom line is forming a habit, brushing consistently, brushing for the right amount of time is all that it takes. Here's the dirty little secret. You don't even need toothpaste. Toothpaste is just to freshen your breath. The fact of the matter, you want to keep your teeth at their best. You've got to brush. I love my Quip. Gave it to my sister. Her dentist said thank you to me. Not directly. I mean, through my sister. But he was like, your teeth look much better. What are you doing? My brother got me a Quip. There it is, folks. Everybody in my family now is a Quip. They have them for kids, too. Saul loves it. These are not big, clunky machines that are going to fall off your sink and then drop down on the floor, and then you're going to have to clean it. No. They're basically the size of an average toothbrush, except for these are ones that are electric and send pulses. This is a simple way to support our show and start brushing better. Quip starts at just $25, and you get the first refill free at quip.com/majority. Getquip.com/majority. It's getquip.com/majority. Like I say, simple way to support the show and start brushing better. but you have to go to GetQuip, GetQuip.com/majority, GetQuip.com/majority to get your first refill free. Now, we're going to go to an interview I did just on Thursday of last week with Naomi Klein about her latest book, On Fire. Be right back after this. So, Naomi, your latest book, the On Fire, the Burning Case for a Green New Deal. This is a book that is a compilation of things that you have written or talks that you have given over the course of almost, I guess, about 10 years with an introduction that in and of itself, I feel like could have been its own short book. I just want to talk just a little bit about what's the idea behind being able to watch this argument lay out over the course of 10 years.
Well, so I've been making the case for why responding to the climate crisis is actually an opportunity to fix a truly broken economic system for a long time now. And so, you know, as momentum has built for the Green New Deal, and I've been writing about that and speaking about that over the past year, it just seemed useful to put it in the context of where this idea comes from. It is not a brand new idea. It's been part of the climate justice movement for a long time. And, you know, the other reason, I guess, to sort of have that 10-year arc for me is it also shows what's at stake, because in that short decade, we've lost a lot of ground. We've lost the Great Barrier Reef. We've lost a hell of a lot of Arctic ice. We're losing the Amazon. It's a reminder that even though we still tend to think about the climate crisis as this sort of slow moving, disaster that we have some time to deal with. It's really, really speeding up. And the more we stall, the more we lose. And it's also just speeding up. I mean, as we speak, a 1.5 million people in California don't have electricity.
Right.
Because we are in this. This is not a future disaster. We are in it.
How has, and I have to say that, you know, one of the things that I think maybe, you know, I mean, I think I was probably primed for this on some level, but one of the things that I think that I came away from your book was sort of and maybe part of that is just the introduction of the Green New Deal, is to understand that climate crisis is not something that is siloed, and is, in fact, even more connected to all the other issues that we talk about than I think maybe we give it credit for. To what extent over the course of those 10 years, what was your trajectory in understanding it that way?
So my trajectory is that I don't come from the environmental side of this. You know, I think you and I first talked probably, 15 years ago. Yep. Or more, when we were talking about the invasion of Iraq, disaster capitalism, the shock doctrine.
Yep.
And so, you know, I'm more of an economics person, a human rights, labor rights person. And so that's my background. And I kind of, it's not that I didn't think climate change was an important issue, but I think I told myself, like a lot of people who are focused on those sort of immediate kind of emergencies, like lives on the line right now, you know, I kind of told myself a couple of things. One, that climate change was less urgent than whatever it was that I was focused on. And I also told myself that, you know, the environmentalists kind of have it in hand. They seem to have a lot of money compared to the other groups that I tended to be coming across. And so I just sort of triaged, because we live in a time of multiple intersecting emergencies, and we can't all focus on all of them, you know. So I sort of triaged that one and said, we'll let other people deal with that, right? And my wake-up call about the sort of intersections of all these crises was when I was in New Orleans. And I was there in the aftermath of Katrina. The city was still partially underwater. I was working on the shock doctrine. And I was covering the fact that this whole sort of private military infrastructure that I had reported on from Iraq, right, the Halliburtons and the Bechtels and the Blackwaters, had just immediately descended on New Orleans in the aftermath of Katrina as a kind of new frontier for profiteering. And in addition to that, you had all of these opportunists descending on the city, which had been evacuated, going, whoa, this is a great opportunity. It's a blank slate. Let's privatize the school system. Let's get rid of public housing and put up condominiums. And much of that happened. So, you know, what I saw in New Orleans was this intersection of what happens when you systematically starve the public sphere, right? Those levees should never have broken. They broke because of infrastructure failure, just like, by the way, the electricity grid in California is so vulnerable because of years of neglect and privatization. And then this heavy storm comes along, breaks the infrastructure. There's no real response. And you have this overlay of white supremacy and vigilantes coming in, and the response is not let's figure out why this is happening and try to prevent it from happening again. It's, oh, actually, let's build an even more unequal society that's going to be even more brittle in the face of storms. So that's when I realized, like, wait, climate isn't separable from all of these other issues. And it isn't just about things getting wetter and hotter. It's about things getting meaner, more divided, uglier. And I think, frankly, that's what we're seeing at the border. You know, I think we're seeing that writ large globally right now with the rise of xenophobia and strongman figures like Donald Trump.
So, okay, and I'm, you know, like I feel like there's about seven questions I want to ask simultaneously. But so with this understanding that, you know, sort of like the aftermath of a an event that has been that obviously we didn't prepare for, that is a climate issue. Didn't prepare for it in terms of like a certain change in the climate. We didn't prepare for it in terms of attempting to slow the changing climate. And then there were implications after the climate. And on some level, like that is, you know, you talk about climate barbarism. Let's talk about that, because it feels like we are now, at least in terms of folks' awareness and maybe the development of the climate movement, that we are in a different stage because we can look around and there is, at least to the extent that, you know, we're talking about normal people, some recognition that climate is impacting all of these things. It may not be creating all of these things, but it is intensifying the implications of all these things. And so, I mean, talk about barbarism.
I mean, I think one way to understand it is like when you're turning the temperature up, right? When our house is on fire, as Greta Thunberg says, right? Everything inside that house gets worse. So if you already have inequality, it intensifies inequality. If you already have vulnerable populations, they become more vulnerable. And this just stands to reason. You know, it's almost been a year since the Paradise fires in California. And if you look at who died in those fires, it was elderly people. It was disabled people. We saw this after Superstorm Sandy in New York. Who was abandoned in public housing on the 20th floor when they couldn't get down? I mean, it is people who are already vulnerable. It intensifies those vulnerabilities. But we happen to live in a society that is pretty okay with an intense hierarchy of life. This is why, you know, who is impacted by police violence is so unequal. It's why who is thrown in prisons is so unequal. It's why who doesn't have health care is so unequal, and on and on and on. And so what I'm calling climate barbarism is really just what happens when societies that are all that have already found justifications for certain people being sacrificed suddenly finds itself facing these mega disruptions. And so I don't think it's a coincidence that at the moment that climate change becomes pretty impossible to deny, we have the rise of figures in Europe who justify allowing thousands of migrants to drown in the Mediterranean, while you have a Donald Trump who becomes president promising to build a wall, why a figure like Jair Bolsonaro comes to power just running on straight-up hate. I mean, there's a sense, even if people still claim they deny climate change, people know that we are in a period of unprecedented mass migration. People know that things aren't getting better, they're getting worse. There is a sense of scarcity in the air. And so it's very easy for these guys to use a formula that I think we're seeing in many different countries, not just in the U.S., where you have a strongman figure who says, I'm going to protect the sort of real fill in the blanks, like right. Americans, Israelis, Italians, Brazilians, and define these outgroups, right, and pit people against each other and talk about invading armies and so on. And we are also seeing some overt ecofascism. These are people who say, yes, climate change is happening. Yes, more and more people are going to be on the move. And that is all the more reason for us to not just fortress our borders, but inflict tremendous violence on immigrants. And so in New Zealand, the Christchurch terrorist attack at two mosques where more than 50 people were murdered at prayer on March 15th of last year, this year, that shooter said he called himself an ethno-nationalist eco-fascist, and that is why he visited a mosque. And he then inspired the El Paso shooter who went to a Walmart and wrote in his manifesto, I don't think Americans are going to change their way of life, but not everybody can have the same way of life as Americans. So that's why he went to a Walmart, which is frequented by Mexicans, like literally to say Mexicans can't shop like Americans. So this is what I mean by climate barbarism. This is what it looks like to adapt to the reality of climate change without challenging these systems of white supremacy and other forms of supremacist logic. They just intensify. I actually think that we may someday soon look back with nostalgia on the days of right-wing climate change denial.
Well, okay. Has the climate movement on some level, to the extent that it's been constituted and the extent that we have known it for the past, 15, 20 years, I feel like people have been talking about it. And this notion of divestiture and making people awareness and, arguing for the existence of climate change. Has that moment, is the climate movement sort of obviously necessary, but is it now insufficient insofar as we are too close to too close, but also to some extent already in the sort of problem zone, if you will, to simply address the question of people acknowledging that it exists, right? Because the Christchurch, like you said, the Christchurch shooter, he acknowledges it exists.
Exactly.
El Paso.
Exactly.
So, what is the next iteration? And to what extent is it unhelpful to look at it as climate and more as, and this is where we're, obviously this is what your book is many respects is about, is you get to the Green New Deal. To what extent is it, what has to happen to that movement, both in terms of in real terms, but also in the way that it projects itself to the rest of the world?
Right. So this has always been too big for the environmental movement, right? Because this isn't a problem that can be solved by banning a substance or protecting a river. It's much, much broader than that. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change the report that they, that this fateful report that is often cited that came out last year, where they said we had 12 years to cut emissions in half, right? I mean, in the summary of that report, they said it is technically possible to cut global emissions in half in 12 years, but it would require unprecedented transformation in virtually every aspect of society. And then they went on to list them, because our whole economy is built on fossil fuels. So no, the environmental movement is not equipped to pull off the momentum required to transform every aspect of society. That's something that is actually going to require, you know, everybody, you know, every aspect of society at the table, whether, you know, it's farmers, it's workers, it's every possible constituency. So I think what's exciting about the Green New Deal framing is that it reminds us of a time in U.S. history when there were transformations in pretty much every aspect of society in the face of the twin threat of the Great Depression and also the Dust Bowl. So, you know, when we talk about the New Deal, that it's worth remembering that this was not a couple of policies. This was re-regulating the banking sector. It was the Civilian Conservation Corps that planted 2.3 billion trees. It was electrifying rural America. It was a massive renaissance of public funding from the art. It probably built your local library. It built public housing. I mean, so it reminds us that it is possible in the face of grave threats to transform society on a pretty short timeline. I mean, it was 9 years when these transformations happened, and followed by that, the transformations of the Second World War, which transformed American industry and turned it into a war machine. Now, that's not the kind of transformation we need, but it is important to remember that there is that in the history of the United States, because I think the biggest problem we have at the moment is not climate change denial. It's sort of liberal doomism. It's kind of like, yeah, I get that it's a problem, but there's no way we're going to get anything done. And plus, people are too short-sighted and too selfish to change anyway. So, you know, let's just throw in the towel. And there's a lot of that going around these days.
I don't want to get like too quibbly here, but just from a conceptual standpoint, would it have made sense? And I don't know. I guess people could argue about the political efficacy of this, and maybe you have a thought about that as well. But it just, the Green New Deal being called like a new deal. I mean, as opposed to sort of like, you know, because when it's announced as the Green New Deal, people are like, why are you giving job guarantees? I mean, is part of the value of that, that it teaches people like, well, these are the implications of our climate catastrophe, or is it, or does it limit the people's understanding of it, because they perceive it as like, oh, this is something about climate change, which is sort of siloed. Like, I mean, I get like the idea that it's, you know, the Green New Deal as opposed to the New Green Deal, right?
Although a lot of people say New Green Deal.
Well, but that limits it, right? I mean, because that limits it to a New Deal that deals with the green thing and doesn't necessarily signal that, well, no, this is a societal problem that in many ways is like a debt that's like, you know, 150 years overdue. We started with a premise that was problematic in capitalism that we thought like this could last forever, but it can't.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I mean, the way I often talk about it is, I mean, it's a vision for the next economy, because our current system is failing, and it's failing us on multiple fronts. And climate is just the biggest one, is just the sort of meta one that affects everybody. But it, you know, it's also failing workers. It's failing young people on so many fronts. You know, I did when I launched the book, I did the event with Varshni Prakash, who's the executive director of the Sunrise Movement, and, you know, has done so much to put the Green New Deal on the map. And she was saying that, you know, there is such a huge generational gap around the appetite for this kind of change, because her generation has, you know, came of age in the rubble of the 2008 financial crisis, and they see this system failing them on every front, right? Whether it's jobs, you know, whether it's guns in schools, whether it is, tech companies that don't protect them from online hate and misogyny. It's just nothing is working, and so the idea that you could have an an infrastructure for a next system, like an overall system upgrade, is actually really exciting. Now, your question about whether or not calling it green limits it, I mean, maybe. But at this point, you know, I think that the real truth is that the reason why there's pushback is because there's a lot of money on the line. And this is going to cost fossil fuel companies and the banks that fund them many, many billions, if not trillions of dollars in wealth that they had planned to exploit as the planet burned. So no matter what you called it, they would
right.
be slinging mud on it at it on Fox News, plus the fact that the entire right-wing infrastructure, you know, the entire think tank infrastructure exists as a counter-revolution to the original New Deal. So they're going to hate whatever New Deal it is, because what they hate is public funding, and they hate getting taxed, and they hate having to take responsibility for anything. So the idea that we have a kind of a branding problem, I don't really buy. I think this is ultimately about power, and whatever this was called, you know, we would be in the fight of our lives.
Right. I mean, and I mentioned that more just less for about a branding question and more just like conceptually in terms of like, you know, what needs to happen and to what extent we need to educate people of this dynamic that, you know, our capitalist system was built on a premise that was faulty, and you can't, you know, we went pretty far down the road till we figured that out on some level, which is that we just don't have these infinite resources. We're not going to be able to, innovate our way out of this on some level. To what extent, though, too, is there this question of, you know, this sort of, I guess, I mean, I remember, was it Koval? He was a Green candidate, and maybe 15 years ago, watching his response to Al Gore's movie, like a More Inconvenient Truth or something to that effect, was his documentary, which was basically saying, like, you know, people are going to have less. I mean, on some level, like, talk about that notion. I mean, it reminds me on some level with a caller that we have on this program who called me years ago when in the wake of the Affordable Care Act and Vermont's attempt at going for a Medicare for all there, where it's like, we've got to tell people there's going to be more taxes because we don't want to surprise them. I mean, it's still a benefit. But what about that notion of just like explaining to people like, yeah, I mean, we're not going to get rid of hamburgers, but we're sort of going to get rid of hamburgers.
Yeah, I think, in the book I talk about George Monbiot, a British author and columnist. He talks about the idea of private limits and public luxury, which is the idea that when it comes to our individual God-given right to just shop as a way of life and buy as much disposable crap as we want and just be free of any kind of limits whatsoever, yeah, that's not that is the problem. And we are going to have to be honest that there are going to be limits to how much over consumers can consume. And I stress over consumers because it's not everybody. It's you know, 70% of global emissions come from the 20% richest people. So it is you and me, but it isn't everybody. And the reason why I like the framing of private limits and public luxury is that it is that what I think is exciting about really fleshing out what a Green New Deal could mean is that there are areas where we can have abundance, where we can have conditions that are better than what we have right now, which is why I think it is important that Medicare for All is part of it, the right to child care is part of it, that jobs guarantee is part of it, a rebooted civilian conservation corps, which is about, you know, this original civilian conservation corps created 800 state parks and about the right of people to have access to nature. It's why I talk a lot about the original New Deal's support for the arts and the fact that it led to a renaissance in American art and tens of thousands of new works of art in the country. We can have abundance in those areas. They're actually low carbon, and you know, not necessarily touring art, but if you say everybody has the right to art in their local communities, that can be done in a pretty low carbon way. I just did an event with called Care Work is Climate Work, where I brought together nurses and teachers and home care workers. You know, pointing out that part of the reason why we don't think of this as green jobs is because it's done by women, but it actually doesn't burn a lot of carbon to take care of each other. And so we can have big investments in those sectors. We can pay those workers better. This is the fastest growing sector in our economy, actually, is home care workers, because there's an aging population. And this really matters because, you know, I mentioned the Paradise Fire and the fact that it was elderly people and disabled people who died. This happens in disaster after disaster. So we are going to face more disasters. We have emitted enough carbon that things are going to get hotter. Even if we do everything right now, things are going to get worse when it comes to climate change. We can't avoid that. And so these investments in healthcare and in that sort of infrastructure that builds stronger communities and makes sure that our public infrastructure is stronger when the disasters hit, it's not an add-on. It's actually how lives are saved in these disasters. I mean, you think about Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico and the fact that, you know, somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 people died in the months after Maria. It wasn't because of falling debris. It was because of neglected infrastructure and a broken healthcare system and people not being able to plug in their respirators. That's what actually kills people. So there's a lot that we can do that will make people's lives better in the day-to-day, which will also save lives in the context of climate change.
I mean, just as you described that notion of, like, you know, more parks, more sort of like families getting together and taking care of them, more personal care on some level. It sounds a little bit, you know, Leave It to Beaver-ish. Like, I mean, it seems like there is room for sort of a simpler time, you know, get back to when things were a little bit less complicated. I mean, on some level, that's part of the pitch, right?
Well, the truth is that there's a ton of data that shows that what actually increases well-being is these types of public investments. Like, there's a reason why people are happy in Denmark, even though it's like cold and dark a lot of the year. It's because they have massive investments in, you know, public recreation, and there are these incredible sort of, you know, indoor swimming parks that people can take their families to and things like that. So I don't know if it's leave it to Beaver exactly, because in some ways that's the antithesis, this sort of suburban nuclear family, everybody in their own little box. You know, I think what actually makes people happy is a sense of community and deriving our joy and identity from things other than just going to the mall, which actually doesn't make people happy. I mean, we're in, you know, an opioid crisis, an addiction crisis, an isolation and loneliness crisis. So a lot of what was promised as being, you know, the American dream and the route to happiness doesn't actually deliver, which is great for capitalism, because then you just go shopping some more and hope that this time this will really do the trick. But that sort of those investments in access to nature, access to art, stronger communities, less work, a shorter work week so that people have time to spend with their friends and family. You know, I don't know if I'd call it Leave It to Beaver. It's kind of more of a Mediterranean way of life, which isn't half bad.
Well, I don't want to get too deep into an argument about Leave It to Beaver. When I think of it, it's just like...
Okay, I'm going to be honest with you that I've never watched it.
Okay, because when I think about it, I just think of, like, kids riding their bikes...
Yes.
And just walking around and it being sunny and everybody seems to be relaxed. Nobody's rushing anywhere. I don't know. That quality of, like, where life was simple. You don't need both parents necessarily working. There was no, you know, talk of, like, how are we going to pay the electrical bill? I mean, everybody's just seemed to be content. I mean, there was obviously a lot of problems that Leave It to Beaver was hiding, but just I guess as a kid, that was my perception of that world. And on some level, you know, that's the type of sentimentality that sells, at least on its surface in this country. I think there's some darker things underneath it a lot of times, but it would be interesting to see if the left on some level can at least sell the wrapping of that. And so, all right, let me ask you sort of maybe this is the converse question on some level. You talk about Christchurch, and you wrote this obviously before what happened in El Paso. To what extent do you think that there is? And so part of this is, like, you know, part of what you argue in the book is that we need to have an answer for this sort of, like, you know, we need to have the post-Katrina answer before Katrina hits, essentially. Do you think there is, and we need to do that because we don't want to leave a vacuum for what took place post Katrina in New Orleans, which was, you know, some type of like paramilitary coming in and then all this privatization. There's not a public school, I think, in New Orleans that exists anymore. A lot of people were displaced. A lot of people, you know, never came back. And it just ended up being, you know, hedge funds going in there and privatizing a lot of it. To what extent, you know, and I think, you know, it's pretty clear that we need to have a solution, even if we're not ready to implement it yet. But to what extent do you think that there is a, I don't know if I want to call it eco-fascist or a soft eco-fascist. I mean, to what extent do you think that there is another solution that the neoliberal regime or whatever you want to call it has already started to work on? Like, I mean, if the idea is that we need to fill the void with a competing narrative, what do you think the other narratives are out there? I mean, there's the eco-fascist one. I mean, is there a soft eco-fascist one that's happening? I mean, I guess I say that just because, like, it occurs to me, like, why do we need a passport now to go into Canada, you know, as opposed to a driver's license? Like, is somebody, do people realize, like, it's probably good to do this now because Canada might get filled up later?
Well, I don't think it was Canada that was driving it. The passport thing, I think, came from the U.S.
I can push the conspiracy even further. But I mean, I'm just using that as an example. But, you know, the wild-eyed 3 in the morning when I don't feel well is like, of course we've done that because we're going to take Canada over and we just want to make sure that we get to choose who comes in. But
oh, gosh. You know, I'm Canadian. I've been living in the States for a little while now. and one of the things that I find interesting is like the role of Canada in the imagination here. And I don't think that the Handmaid's Tale, you know, the sort of narrative in the Handmaid's Tale where everybody gets to just go to Canada and they get their, like, you know, free health care in their care package. I'm not so sure Canada is going to play that role, but that's another conversation.
Well, but I mean, on some level, it's conceivable that if we head down this road, Canada is going to be to the States as the States is on some level. I mean, obviously there's different resources and as you know, the United States is to Guatemala, right? Like, there's going to be some,
no doubt,
it's conceivable, like, there's refugees.
The U.S. is more climate vulnerable.
Right.
You know, I think, look, just because there's more south, and the southern states are in the thick of it right now. You know, Austin is 10 degrees hotter this year consistently this September than this September has been 10 degrees hotter than average. So in terms of your question
and I don't want to get caught up but I mean, is there another plan that is out there? I mean, the eco-fascist has theirs. We're going to just shoot. We're going to literally just...
Okay, so exactly. But I think so that's the eco-fascist. But I think the soft, quote-unquote, plan is just a kind of eco-apartheid or climate apartheid, which is just this sort of fortress borders and, you know, the discourse of legal, illegal, you know, security threat, you know, not security threat, that has risen up in Australia, the European Union, the U.S., and the MO actually comes from Australia, where I think about a decade ago, the Australian government introduced this their island solution plan to how to deal with migrants coming to Australia. And the idea was, we're not going to let the boats land. We're going to intercept the boats, and we're going to send migrants to offshore detention camps on these remote islands. They had one in Nauru, which is a very small Pacific island, and another in Manus. They are privatized camps. They're run by for-profit companies. And the idea is that you pay these countries who are poor. It's a new model of economic development for desperate countries, of like, we'll pay you to be our jailers. And this is sometimes referred to as the Australian solution, and the European Union has started to adopt it. And so that's why it has become illegal for humanitarian boats to rescue people off the coasts of Italy and Greece, because now the European Union has outsourced the patrols to what they call the Syrian Coast Guard. I say in quotes because they're basically warlords, and they intercept the boats, or they don't. And many people are being left to drown. But when there is a distress signal, it is the Libyans that go, and they take them to these camps that are concentration camps where murder, where rape and torture are rampant. And now what we're seeing with Trump is something very similar, right? I mean, it's
Guatemala as a safe third country, essentially, or
exactly.
Making a deal with Mexico.
Keep
right.
them in Mexico. Make a deal with Honduras. Make a deal with El Salvador. First, you cut aid, right? So you increase the desperation, and then you say, here's your new model for economic development. You can be the jailer for migrants, and we'll give you some money for it, and you'll use our private contractors for it. So, I mean, this is not off in the future. We are seeing this take shape right now.
That's disturbing. I know you just got a couple minutes here, so let's finish with something that's maybe a little bit more hopeful. At one point, I think it in the book you write that we're live, and I don't know the exact quote, but to something to the effect of like, We're here at the last possible moment to really basically slow the roll, as it were, or to address it. Is that optimistic? I mean, is that positive? I mean, let's end this on something.
I think we should all feel the weight of our of what it means to be alive in this moment in history, because we do have a window, and it's not a window to stop climate change. We are in climate change. It is going to get worse. But if we are lucky, if we do absolutely everything within our power, we should be able to stop truly catastrophic unraveling. And the space in which humans are going to be able to live on this planet is going to contract. That is part of what we're dealing with. We're going to be living on less of the globe. But we have this window, and there is something that is happening out there, because there is a massive generational shift. 7 million people participated in the climate strikes a few weeks ago. I think Greta Thunberg, may well win the Nobel Prize. Well, you'll know. I don't know when this is airing, but we'll find out tomorrow. Probably I shouldn't have said that.
No, that's all right.
But, it's the kind of numbers that we're seeing at very, very short notice speaks to the fact that people really, really want to do something. We're also seeing it in the polls. I mean, I've been writing about this issue for a long time, and one of the most frustrating things is that even among people who say they care about climate change, if you ask them to rank, ask people to rank their concern, they'll reliably place it last after pretty much everything else. Now, in the Democratic primaries, people are putting it up there with healthcare as their number one concern. So there is a shift, and And for the first time, we are talking about the scale of change that the crisis actually demands, you know, which isn't to say that every candidate, you know, vying to lead the Democratic Party gets it, but a few of them really do. And so this is a game changer. It's never happened before. We've only ever talked about, you know, what's better, a cap and trade or a marginal carbon tax. We have never talked about the sort of transformation that the crisis actually demands, understanding that actually this could be, you know, a historic job creator. We actually have an opportunity to address many, many crises at the same time if we do this right, if we design this right. So, you know, I wouldn't say that it's like sunny optimistic, but I do believe we have a chance to do something that isn't just better than a future of, you know, apocalyptic climate breakdown. I actually think that if we do this right, we have a chance to do something that's better than Tuesday.
The book is On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal. We will put a link to it at majority.fm. Naomi Klein, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the lie ball. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice was made. Option where you don't get paid for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes?